From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The rough transcript of President Trump's phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was released this morning. Trump asked Zelensky to do the U.S. a favor by working with his attorney, Rudy Giuliani. Giuliani was looking into Hunter Biden's work for a Ukrainian-owned gas company. We'll examine the conversation and its implications on possible impeachment after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We have a lot to talk about this morning in light of yesterday's announcement from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi that an impeachment inquiry would be moving forward against President Donald Trump. Also this morning, the release of the rough transcript of the phone call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine, President Zelensky. That was made in late July. That was a portion of the subject of the whistleblower's complaint that investigated by the intelligence community's inspector general, who found a potential violation of campaign finance law because of the president's reference of Hunter and Joe Biden in that phone call. And then from there, the determination made by the Justice Department that there would not be a criminal investigation. But we're going to go through and look at that rough transcript, a number of the points that are raised in it, and examine that. We're also going to look at the legal issues that come into play, the process of impeachment, and then later on look at the political dimensions of this as well. First, let's hear with a little bit more detail Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, what he had to say in a news conference about half an hour ago about what was included in the rough transcript.
The notes of the call reflect a conversation far more damning than I or many others had imagined. It is shocking at another level that the White House would release these notes and felt that somehow this would help the president's case or cause. Because what those notes reflect is a classic mafia-like shakedown of a foreign leader. They reflect a Ukrainian president who was desperate for U.S. support, for military support to help that country in a hot war with Putin's Russia, and at the same time, a president of the United States who immediately after the Ukraine president expresses the need for further weapons tells the Ukraine president that he has a favor to ask.
Well, let's talk about what's specifically in the rough draft of the conversation. Joining us from Politico, White House correspondent and associate editor for the news site, Anita Kumar. Anita, good to have you with us again. First of all, just characterize, if you will, the response in D.C. today to this release.
Well, I'm actually in New York traveling with the president, who we're going to hear from later when he has a news conference. But what I am hearing from D.C. and New York is a little bit of what you would expect, right? The Democrats are saying it's exactly what Congressman Schiff said, which is it's asking a foreign leader to get involved in a political, an election. It's actually asking him to do a favor, a political favor for the president. And from the Republicans hearing that, you know, there is no quid pro quo here. He mentioned it in passing, or he mentioned it on this call, but he didn't say, look, if you don't do this for me, I'll withhold funding or anything like that. So, you know, just like in Washington so many times, it's people talking about sort of seeing what they want to see in something.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics that are included in these notes of the phone conversation, because on the issue of whether this is quid pro quo, the president is talking about the lack of European support for Ukraine and brings up Angela Merkel. And the president says a lot of the European countries are the same way. So I think it's something you want to look at. But the United States has been very, very good to Ukraine. I wouldn't say that it's reciprocal necessarily, because things are happening that are not good. But the United States has been very, very good to Ukraine. So this, Anita, would be a place where critics of the president would look and say, here, though may not be explicit quid pro quo, the president is talking about how good the U.S. has been to Ukraine, sort of setting the table for, well, what are you going to do in return?
Yes, exactly. And you heard Democrats immediately say that today, that they that he didn't just have to say, look, I'll give you this if you give me that. But that this is, I believe the Congressman Schiff said it was mafia-like, where you know sort of what the president is saying. He's saying, he's mentioning the aid, he's mentioning the help that they give for the country. And then really almost the next thing he says is, hey, can you do me a favor? So, you know, they're saying, you know, the Democrats on Capitol Hill are saying it doesn't have to be, you know, very explicit. It was explicit enough.
President Zelensky, in responding to what President Trump says, and I'm selectively quoting, but trying to find what's the most relevant of the exchange here to the issue. President Zelensky says, I would also like to thank you for your great support in the area of defense. We are ready to continue to cooperate for the next steps. Specifically, we are almost ready to buy more javelins from the United States for defense purposes. President Trump, at least according to the notes, immediately responds, I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike, dot, dot, dot. I guess you have one of your wealthy people, dot, dot, dot. The server, they say Ukraine has it. There are a lot of things that went on, the whole situation. I think you're surrounding yourself with some of the same people. I would like to have the Attorney General call you or your people, and I would like you to get to the bottom of it. As you saw yesterday, that whole nonsense ended with a very poor performance by a man named Robert Mueller, an incompetent performance. But they say a lot of it started with Ukraine. Whatever you can do, it's very important that you do it if that's possible. So, Anita, first of all, it's not clear that this is word for word, because those dot, 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 there may be other parts of the conversation that are not notated here. But what is the reference to CrowdStrike? What does that mean?
Yeah, well, before I say that, let me just tell you what the White House is saying about those ellipses.
Oh, great. Okay.
Because so many people have noticed those. They're saying it was a pause that, you know, in pause in a regular conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing was deleted. If they had deleted anything, it would have been more in a bracket.
Okay.
So, you know, I know that some people don't believe that. I'm just sharing with you what the administration.
Sure. No, that's good to know. And that's plausible given the beginnings and ending of the sentences that are on either side. And then on CrowdStrike, what is the reference there to that cybersecurity company?
Yeah, if you'll remember, this relates to the investigation into what Russia did in the election, in the 2016 election, and it relates to social media companies and companies sort of infiltrating computers and social media sites and ads and things in the United States. Why it was a little bit surprising to me to hear that he had brought that up again, you know, sort of that I sort of feel like a lot of people had moved on from that and that wasn't still an issue. You know, the Mueller investigation happened and other investigations have looked into this. So I don't know if he's sort of saying he's disputing that, you know, this company or Russia was involved. But that was a little bit surprising to me because we had sort of moved on from that.
Then President Zelensky responds, talking about the importance of partnership with the United States. President Trump comes back and says, I heard you had a prosecutor who was very good and he was shut down. And that's really unfair. A lot of people are talking about that, the way they shut your very good prosecutor down. And you had some very bad people involved. Mr. Giuliani is a highly respected man. He was the mayor of New York City, a great mayor. And I would like him to call you. I would will ask him to call you along with the Attorney General. Rudy very much knows what's happening, and he's a very capable guy. If you could speak to him, that would be great. The former ambassador from the United States, the woman, was bad news, and the people she was dealing with in the Ukraine were bad news. So I just want to let you know that. The other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution. So if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me. So there are a number of issues in there. First of all, the prosecutor who was looking into corruption within Ukraine, Anita, can you briefly explain to us what led to that person being fired?
Yeah, I mean, this is a top prosecutor for the country, and there was a lot of talk. Now, this is back several years. This is when President Obama was president. Joe Biden was vice president. He was sort of President Obama's liaison, if you will, to Ukraine. He made a number of calls and was in, you know, constant sort of contact with them. He did pressure that he wanted this prosecutor to be fired. There had been a lot of concerns about him. And, you know, but this is also the prosecutor who was looking into the company that Joe Biden's son, Hunter, was involved with. He was a director there. That, my understanding is that that investigation into that gas company had already ended or sort of was dormant at that time that Joe Biden was calling for this prosecutor to be fired. The prosecutor did leave, was fired. And, you know, Joe Biden has talked about this a number of times over the years. He has said that he had never talked to his son, Hunter Biden, about this issue. He'd never talked about that business, and the two things were unrelated. But as you can tell, that is what Republicans and the president are saying is, well, how can they be unrelated? They were the same man. There was the same prosecutor that was looking into to both of those things, or, you know, that was involved, that was looking into the son, and also that the vice president, then vice president, wanted to get to fire.
All right. And then the ambassador Yovanovitch, who was replaced, what was explained at the time as the reason why she was replaced?
Yeah, I think there was just a lot of sort of wholesale. This is, remember, this is the president now is a new president. So there was a lot of change going on there in Ukraine at that time. And there were a lot of changes going on. Remember, this is the time that we saw some Russian aggression in Ukraine as well. So, the you know, it's not so much happening now, but at the time when President Obama was president, this was a big, you know, issue for them that they were really helping and sort of dealing with Ukraine at the time. So there were a lot of changes going on.
All right. Just Anita, before I let you go, what's the timeline now for the House of Representatives and the, I think there's six different investigations to move forward?
Yeah, there's actually six different committees and a number of investigations. So it's not just Ukraine, even though we're all talking about that today. It's the tax returns. It's the emoluments, if you'll remember that. Is the president benefiting from his business? Is he using the office of the president to benefit his businesses? It's so many different investigations, and these six committees are going to be looking at all of them and then handing over the ones that they think are the most serious to the Judiciary Committee. And then the committee, the Judicial Committee, will sort of make a determination on which of these things, if any, warrant impeachment, and then they will, you know, they can vote on that and recommend that to the full House. You know, I've been doing reporting all day on this, on how this works, because I think there's a sense that, you know, things will happen next week. It really is not that fast. It's, you know, it could take months, really, for these investigations to go through. In the two previous, you know, presidents in recent times where this has happened, it actually took quite a long time. I don't expect it to take that long, but to go and try to get these documents that they want and to do these investigations, they're still going to have to probably go to court, to take the administration to court to get some of these things. So I think that inherently just takes a long time.
Nomiki, thanks so much. Anita, thank you so much for being with us and talking about your coverage of this. Anita Kumar, Politico's White House correspondent and associate editor. Coming up, we'll talk with Nomiki Konst, former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission, and we'll get her thoughts on what's going on with this inquiry for impeachment. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Coincidentally, President Trump and the Ukrainian president with a long scheduled meeting for today. And we'll have a news conference featuring President Trump coming up in the 1 o'clock hour. You'll hear that live right here on 89.3 KPCC. Right now, we're talking about the rough transcript, the notes of the phone conversation between President Trump and the Ukrainian president, as well as the impeachment inquiry that the House of Representatives Democratic majority is launching. With me, former member of the Democratic National Committee Unity Reform Commission, which worked to increase participation in the Democratic Party, Nomiki Konst. Nomiki, good to have you with us again. I do want to ask you about the political dimension of this. Are you concerned that if there is not strong support among the American public for impeachment, that this could end up backfiring on the Democratic Party?
That is the ultimate question here. I'm not so much as concerned for the presidential election, which, of course, is next year. But what I think is interesting is, in terms of the presidential election and the presidential primary, of course, with Biden being in this investigation, supposed investigation, it muddles things a little bit. But impeachment has been, for the most part, carried and campaigned for by the most progressive side of the Democratic Party, which turns out in primaries, presidential primaries, local primaries, congressional primaries, Senate primaries, they're the most active, you know, members of the party. So I think it could end up helping progressives, especially in congressional districts, to win primaries, especially if they're running against more centrist members. So it's pushing centrist members like Nancy Pelosi herself to be a little bit more bold on this. You're seeing that move, and of course, we've seen it in the last couple of days. Now, in terms of the Senate, I mean, there's 12 seats up next year in the Senate, and there are a handful that are more likely to be swing districts. So it would be interesting to see how that dynamic plays as approval for impeachment grows. Right now, it is not strong enough. The public opinion as of last week was split with 12% undecided. You know, when you go state by state, it could be a little bit different. I haven't seen the state by state polls on this with the Democratic Party base. I think that, you know, you have to look at those independents in those swing districts and where they lean. Traditionally, meaning since Donald Trump has been elected, independents in these swing districts tend to be more opposed to Trump. So if that's what the Democrats need to win a couple of more Senate seats, then this could be very good for the Democratic Party, aside from the presidential election.
But it would seem that in those states, you've got, you know, where you've got a seat at play, the question would be whether more moderate voters who would be essential to flipping, right, would be on board with the impeachment process and would feel like, yeah, this is so egregious, the president should be impeached before the election.
Right. And where this is where looking at polls, micro-targeting them, looking at them in specific districts and states and really getting into the nuance is important, because moderate voters right now are not fully in favor of impeachment, but they are extremely critical of Donald Trump. So is it possible that you could move those voters? Very likely, especially in the last week.
Nomiki, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us. Nomiki Konst joining us. She was a Bernie Sanders surrogate in 2016 and a former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission. Also joining us, distinguished professor of jurisprudence at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, constitutional law specialist Michael Gerhart, who's author of two books, not just one, but two books on the federal impeachment process. Professor Gerhart, good to have you with us. Appreciate it very much.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've had a chance to take a look at this transcript. Your thoughts on this and the potential pegs for impeachment?
Well, yes, I have taken a look at the transcript or what's been released so far, and it seems quite reasonable for the House Speaker to say, look, we've got to investigate this. There's a lot in the conversations that we've read so far that's rather disturbing. Several times the president brings up the need, his desire to have the vice president, former Vice President Joe Biden, investigated, and he's bringing it up oftentimes in the context, as you've already noted, in which he might be expect this as a favor, or this would help us, or help me. And the critical thing here is we have the President of the United States asking a foreign leader to help him with his own election. It's not something that's important to national security. It's not important to the American people generally, but it's important to the president personally. That's pretty much the definition of an impeachable offense.
So if the president had only mentioned about, you know, it's important that you look at corruption and that sort of that was the condition of U.S. support, that wouldn't necessarily run afoul of the law or ethics as it did by mentioning Biden by name?
It's hard to say because everything depends so much on context. But the critical thing is he's holding up aid that has been authorized by Congress, and Congress didn't put conditions on it, which he seems to be doing here. And so he's usurping congressional authority at the same time he's trying to get a favor done for himself personally. And so that's disturbing enough to justify an inquiry. And that's the critical question out there. Now, does it make sense to look into this? And I would think most people would think, yeah, if any president did this, it's worth looking at.
The challenge is, and this was laid out prior by a guest, so much of this is eye of the beholder, that people who are sympathetic toward President Trump are going to look at this and say, you know, there's not an explicit quid pro quo here. It's not inappropriate for a president to, you know, make some personal sort of an ask here about corruption. Maybe it's skirting ethics, but, you know, certainly not to the level of impeachment. And on the other side, you've got, as Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, you know, put it, seeing this as egregious mafia-like, you know, conduct. So how do you get out of that, you know, loggerhead?
Well, so the two things. I mean, the first is that it is inappropriate for the President of the United States to ask for a personal favor, a favor that allows him some personal gain from a foreign leader that's not part of a negotiation on behalf of American interests. So that in itself is problematic. I would think people generally would be disturbed by that. If we just said, if President X asked a foreign leader to help him get reelected or to help him with his election, would that be a problem? I think most people would say, yeah. And the second thing is that I should hope we don't narrow impeachment simply to where there's an express quid pro quo, because then anybody who doesn't use the magic words has no problem. No, we have to look at the context. And within this context, it's quite clear that the president is trying to secure this favor with some hint or indication that it would help the relationship between the two countries. And that's quite disturbing.
We're talking with University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Distinguished Professor of Jurisprudence Michael Gerhart. He, by the way, was the only legal expert invited to speak behind closed doors to the entire House of Representatives during the impeachment proceedings against President Clinton. He was the only joint witness to testify as well before the House Judiciary Committee. So you've seen this process up close. You've been a participant in it. What can we expect over the coming weeks, Professor?
Well, I think the first thing we should expect is that there's going to be some organizational work done by the House, particularly by the House Judiciary Committee. It's got to get coordinated with the other committees that may have relevant information. And then you'll probably see the committees begin to do some fact-finding, some further investigation. They may want to consider, as the House Judiciary Committee did with Clinton, on the question of what constitutes an impeachable offense and get some sort of expert advice on that. But most of what we'll probably see will take some time. That's typically what happens with impeachments. They aren't done in one day. And so I think what the main thing to watch for is the investigation that's being done and what it uncovers.
And the articles of impeachment, I don't recall from the impeachment of Bill Clinton, does that lay out specific charges against the president related to the testimony in these committees?
Generally speaking, the answer is yes. So the charges will be based on the evidence that comes forward. Recall that with President Clinton, there were no witnesses testifying about facts. The House Judiciary Committee relied entirely on the Starr referral, and so there weren't witnesses coming forward about facts or factual questions. And so I think that it's – but if we look at impeachments generally, they're based on the fact-finding that the House does, and that helps to give a indicate what the framework should be for charging the president with impeachable misconduct.
Given that the U.S. Senate, at least at this point, seems highly unlikely to vote to remove President Trump from office, do you think it still makes sense for the House of Representatives to go forward and potentially impeach?
I think the answer is yes, but I think it's much more to ask the people, you know, the House leadership. They seem to think it makes sense, and that's the important thing. What the Senate does is not entirely under the control of the House, but any time a president faces impeachment or is charged with impeachment formally, that's a serious thing. There have only been two American presidents charged in impeachment and who have had trials in the Senate. So that's one of the most serious processes we have under our Constitution. And if it were to happen, that alone marks this presidency and not in a good way.
Could the U.S. Senate, its majority, refuse to hold a trial if it receives the articles of impeachment passed by the House? Could it just say, we're not going to hold a trial on this?
Historically, the Senate's always done something, even when they didn't think anything would come of it. For example, Clinton, they still held some process. They've never refused to accept the articles of impeachment when delivered by the House. It's just a formal proceeding in which they literally are carried over and somebody in the Senate receives them. But the Senate has never then just kind of thrown them in the trash or done nothing. That would be unprecedented. Quite unusual for the Senate simply to say, we don't think there's anything serious enough here even to read it or to look at.
Sir, as a legal scholar, is there anything to this beyond it being a political exercise? Because we often hear this really isn't looking at charges in the same way as a criminal prosecution would be undertaken, that this is essentially a political act. Do you see it extending beyond that?
It is a political act, but it's a political act that's authorized by the Constitution. So we should think of it as a constitutional process. It does have a political side to it in that the decision makers are political actors, but there's a formula for impeachment that's set forth in the Constitution. The Constitution defines the scope of impeachable offenses. That guides the decision making. And so this process is a very serious one, and it's not, you'd have to expect politics to enter into it, but it's the whole purpose of it is to get beyond politics to see what the facts are and to follow them.
I want to thank you, Professor Gerhardt, for being with us today. We appreciate it. From the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, distinguished Professor Michael Gerhardt joining us. As I mentioned, he was the only legal expert invited to testify behind closed doors to the entire House of Representatives during the impeachment proceedings against President Clinton during 1997-1998. As we continue on Air Talk, we'll speak with Republican political analyst Sean Walsh. We'll also talk with Matt Barreto, who's UCLA professor of political science and Chicano studies. And we'll talk with California's RNC National Committee woman, Harmeet Dhillon, get her take on this as well. We're talking about the impeachment inquiry announced yesterday by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, as well as the release this morning of the notes from the conversation on July 25th between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine. By the way, the two men are meeting later today, a news conference scheduled in the 1 o'clock Pacific time hour. We will be bringing you that news conference live right here on 89.3 KPCC. And our phone lines are open for you for your political analysis on impeachment. What do you think the implications are, if any, for the 2020 presidential election? 866-893-KPCC. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, we'll take a look back at the two previous impeachments of presidents, Bill Clinton, Andrew Johnson, and we'll look at the near impeachment of Richard Nixon. We'll look back at those events historically and compare them to the impeachment inquiry which the House of Representatives is undertaking. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us, and I welcome your calls with your analysis of what the political effect will be of the House undertaking impeachment. Do you think that its effect on the 2020 presidential election will be such it potentially makes it more difficult for President Trump to be reelected? Or do you think that because of how differently people are likely to view what's in this transcript, that it ends up actually benefiting the president? 866-893-KPECC. Let me read some listener comments that are posted on our page. Astrid Goth writes on the page, if they impeach Trump on what are mostly political reasons, then the floodgates will be open. The next president will get impeached for burping in public, especially if it's a Democrat. Pippi writes, impeaching Trump is a waste of time and resources. Better to use the incident to get people to get out and vote and remind people on November 2nd, 2020. Quit chasing the glitter squirrel, she says. Focus on what's really important, getting a candidate that can win against Trump. Joaquin in South L.A. writes, Congress can narrow or broaden impeachment as much as they want. They'll narrow it to explicit quid pro quo if they think that's the only impeachment that voters will support. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. And my question isn't specifically, is it right or wrong to impeach? My question is, how, if at all, you think it will affect the 2020 presidential race? Because, of course, that's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's calculus. She didn't see an advantage for Democrats in pursuing it. But when yesterday she had those groups, the Democratic House members who were more moderates coming to her and saying they were now backing impeachment, that's what seemed to swing things in the House. With me, Republican political analyst Sean Walsh. Sean, good morning. First of all, your thoughts on the political effect of this.
Well, I think that Pippi, Astrogoth, and Joaquin are all correct in what they had to say. I think the political impact is as follows. Number one, Nancy Pelosi didn't do anything today or yesterday that she hasn't not done in the past 6 months. She didn't form a special committee. It's the same six committees that have been looking at all the same issues over time. She just basically said, this is, you know, impeachment proceedings, kind of what Nadler's been saying and doing all along. I do think what's critical to note is the American public is also has an impeachment proceeding, Larry, and it's the impeachment part, the investigation is a campaign for presidency, and the trial and conviction is election day. And so the American public has that capacity and does that every 4 years. We are really about a 1 year out from an election, and so the public will make a determination about whether Mr. Trump is fit to serve in office or not serve in office. And I think Pelosi is doing political calculus here, where why go against the current? Why do something where we can, you know, mess up? Just let the investigations happen, then the public and Trump will be tainted enough, and the American people will vote him out.
If there's not more in what the whistleblower has to say, and I guess we're awaiting any word on whether that individual is or individuals are going to be testifying before House committees. But if this is what it is, this rough transcript of the phone conversation, do you think it's going to have a significant effect on public opinion of the president?
I don't think so. But what's happened here is the kabuki kind of curtain has been pulled back on the national security arena. I think one of the very, very interesting things, people are making all these comments, and you know, I heard Jackie Speier out today saying that, you know, is this really the whole transcript? Historically, when presidents do calls with foreign heads of state, they don't record those calls. They actually have official note takers from the NSCU that take those notes, and they don't record those calls for very good reasons. And I saw that the White House put out that this is partly from a voice recognition transcription. So if they have recordings of these calls, I think this potentially opens up a potential huge can of worms for the president, because if this whistleblower is an NSC staffer, and the NSC is staffed up by DIA, CIA, NSA, a whole, you know, alphabet letter of folks that hang out in the White House, do they have other recordings, and is this person making complaints not just simply about this Ukraine issue, but a whole host of other issues? So, you know, the vote is still out. Let's see if there are more issues that actually come forward. And the president, I think, is going to rightly so invoke executive privilege, saying this has national security implications, but the politics and pressure for the foreign oversight committees in both the House and Senate, I think, will be too great for him not to look deeper into that.
Sean, what are the implications for Joe Biden's presidential campaign?
Well, I think they are very, very serious. I mean, let us not forget. So Donald Trump was accused of being basically, you know, Putin's lapdog. And so the interesting thing is, and what I heard on an earlier call, or, you know, earlier discussion today was, you know, and what Schiff said is that when Congress passed aid to Ukraine, that include weapons to be sold to the Ukraine, but the Obama administration decided to basically ignore that. They didn't give any weapons that were authorized by Congress. And so when Trump came in, he actually gave them the weapons, the Javelin missiles and everything else along those lines. So I think if you're going to look at the issues surrounding President Trump and interactions between the national security team with this administration, you're going to have to equally look at what happened in the Obama administration, both with Mr. Biden, who bragged about the fact that he had interfered in discussions and held off money from that issue. So I think it is very, very toxic for Joe Biden. I think Elizabeth Warren is quietly doing, you know, novenas and taking laps around the track, that she's thrilled at this.
Of course, the other side of that is that reportedly the investigation into that gas company on which Hunter Biden served on the board, that had already concluded. And it wasn't just Joe Biden who was pushing for the Ukrainian prosecutor to be removed, but a number of other American allies who were also making that request.
Well, Larry, we have no idea, really. You had a prosecutor who was removed, and we have no idea what the timing or what, you know, messages may or may not have come back from the Ukraine. So, I mean, the bottom line is, I do think that members of the Republican Senate, at least, are going to want to open up and see what happened from the Obama administration going forward. And they will use the same thing. What was U.S. policy then, and what was done, and what's U.S. policy now? So you can say, well, that's smacks of politics. Well, I'm shocked. I'm shocked that going on in the House and the Senate. So I do think it's fair game, and it will happen.
We're talking with Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, also with us from UCLA, professor of political science and Chicano studies, and co-founder of the research and polling firm Latino Decisions, Matt Barreto. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Happy to be here, Larry.
Let me start on the point I was just raising with Sean. Do you think there's cause for concern here for Joe Biden?
Absolutely not. I mean, that was all, you know, Trump talking points, I think, that he circulated to all his talkers this morning. That's there's absolutely no one who believes that Biden was pressuring the removal of the prosecutor to help his son's company that he was on the board of, that he didn't even have a financial interest in. There was widespread calls for that prosecutor to be removed for corruption. And as you just explained, the sequence of events doesn't even support it. So, you know, the longer they want to go down that road, the more it's going to draw attention to what Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump are doing with Ukraine. So probably that's fine from the Biden camp or from any Democratic camp, really. I mean, there's absolutely nothing there. And I don't think it's going to cause anything. I mean, if anything, it gives Biden something to talk about, that Trump was so concerned about his candidacy that he orchestrated this move with Rudy Giuliani and others to try and back channel to Ukraine.
Matt, just real briefly, do you think that this is going to benefit Democrats in that they're taking what they see as a principled stand here, regardless of Senate action? Or do you think there's a potential for it to backfire?
No, I think it's definitely going to benefit because it took a while in the development. So let's go back to the very beginning when there were calls for impeachment, you know, fairly early on, even before the midterm elections. And then you had the Mueller investigation happening. I think all of this really turned the day that Mueller gave his press conference, and he basically laid out to the American people that there was, in fact, obstruction of justice happening, but that he was not able to indict. And he said, it's now up to the Congress to do something. And from there, momentum has just grown very strongly for this impeachment process to move forward.
We're talking with UCLA professor of political science, Matt Barreto. We'll continue our conversation on the impeachment inquiries begun by the Democratic majority of the House of Representatives back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Coming up in just a few minutes, we take a look back at the history of impeachment in the United States. Bill Clinton, Andrew Johnson, and the near impeachment of Richard Nixon as he resigned to avoid the impeachment process. We'll take a look back and see, compare and contrast the what we're expecting to see with President Trump in the weeks and months to come. With me right now is Republican National Committeewoman for California, Harmeet Dhillon. She's an attorney who practices in San Francisco. Harmeet, good to have you with us again on Air Talk. I wanted to ask you about the potential implications with California Republicans. The party has had such a very difficult time here, you know, with statewide candidates and the like. Does an impeachment process potentially hurt or help Republican turnout next year?
Well, I don't really look at it that way. I think an impeachment process is bad for the country overall. As Tulsi Gabbard said yesterday, it's very divisive. But that said, I think that an unjust impeachment process, which has, in my opinion, is what this current process that Nancy Pelosi initiated yesterday is going to galvanize support for the president. So as a practical matter in California, is it going to affect the Electoral College vote distribution from California? Probably not. But will it energize Republicans to go to the polls in March and make sure that they vote for down-ticket candidates who are Republicans? Absolutely yes.
Also, when and you talked about an unjust process, but when you look at the transcript of this, isn't it understandable that some people would look at this and say there's an implied quid pro quo, and that other people, perhaps yourself, would look at it and say, no, that's not the case here. But I mean, isn't there some eye of the beholder here?
Not really. So this process was initiated yesterday with Nancy Pelosi never having seen any of it, and apparently the whistleblower didn't see it either. This is a totally political, concocted nonsense issue, but it's going to end up really hurting Joe Biden pretty badly because I think people have forgotten about his son's corruption issues in China and Ukraine, and now we're going to all be talking about that. Nancy Pelosi, as I've repeatedly said on television, has been the voice of reason in the Democratic Party. She's been strong in pushing back on what she has previously viewed as a losing proposition for Democrats politically. She caved in to the left wing of her party yesterday. I think she's going to really regret that. Because, you know, you can have an eye of a beholder as to this transcript, but if anybody thinks that this set of facts is going to lead to President Trump being impeached, you know, I mean, I'd like to be Miss America, but, you know, my height and my age and my weight are not going to lead to that result. You know, those are the facts of life. And there's no way that 2/3 of the Senate is going to vote to convict the president on this, you know, vague claim.
Well, you mentioned corruption involving Hunter Biden, but isn't it fairly common for people, family members all, to have business interests that might be with other countries, even as their relative holds a position of power in the United States? Is what Hunter Biden did uncommon?
Well, I uncommon or not, it's not right. But what doesn't happen in many of those cases is the dad of this incompetent grifter making threats to another country involving a prosecutor who was investigating his son's ties there. So I think that's the fact pattern that's a little different here. Now, you know, what I think is going to be really interesting, since we've now set this precedent of releasing these transcripts, there's going to be a significant demand to see transcripts of phone calls that the previous administration had with some of these same characters and countries. And I don't think those are going to be savory. I don't think it's a great precedent. I don't think the president should have had to release this innocuous transcript. But if those are the new rules, let's see some more transcripts.
All right, Harmeet Dhillon, thank you for being with us. And just in terms of your characterization of Hunter Biden, we appreciate avoiding that sort of thing, calling someone a grifter and the like. That goes too far. But thank you for joining us. Harmeet Dhillon, RNC National Committee Woman for California. Let me go back to Matt Barreto, UCLA Professor of Political Science. Your response to Harmeet's points.
Well, I thought when she was describing a corrupt president pressuring countries that she was describing the Ukraine call. I mean, it describes it exactly perfectly. I mean, the transcript could not be more clear, or the notes could not be more clear, that the focus of the conversation was on getting Ukraine to open up an investigation into a political rival of the president without any cause. And at the same time, he's withholding large sums of money that the United States had already promised to the Ukraine. And so this is the exact sort of thing that I think needs to come out. I think we need to see more of these sorts of transcripts and calls to see exactly how the president's been operating his presidency. And so I agree with her at the end that I would welcome to see more of these. Let's put everything out that he has said to these foreign leaders in terms of how he is operating. And let's not forget all of the dealings that Paul Manafort had in the Ukraine, and whether or not this is payback for some of that.
I guess as I look at the transcript, Matt, you know, I think back to and I was, you know, I was young, but Richard Nixon and going through Watergate, the country had so turned against him that what was going to happen with Nixon was inevitable. And I look at Bill Clinton, and I didn't have the sense that the country was behind impeachment, that that was largely a partisan endeavor. And I look at this transcript and I look at the potential impeachment of President Trump, and I don't necessarily see a public that's going to be galvanized, as is the case of Richard Nixon, from this transcript. But what do you think?
Well, if you remember the Nixon process, it was very slow moving in public opinion. The Democrats were against him, but it was very slow moving for Republicans. And I think you're seeing a similar thing here, where, as I said earlier, you know, it started with Mueller coming out and saying there was obstruction of justice. It's not, the entire impeachment process is not going to be about the Ukraine phone call. It's going to also be about the obstruction of justice, which the president has basically admitted to. It's going to also be about the emoluments clause and whether or not he's using his position of power to profit his companies. And then it's going to be about the Ukraine business. And I think all of those things put together, with not more stuff that has happened, is going to slowly start getting people thinking about this and thinking what exactly is doing. And so I think you're going to see movement. We're going to keep tracking it in public opinion, but you will see movement.
Sean, can you give me 20 seconds back on that?
Yeah, Professor Barreto is absolutely wrong. Biden actually said that they were walking out for a press conference and I'm holding up $1 billion. I think he's right. They're going to try and throw everything up against the wall, and they're going to try and make it factor into the elections. And I think that, you know, it's a political gambit.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, UCLA professor of political science and Chicano studies, Matt Barreto, who also founded the research and polling firm Latino Decisions. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. In our second hour, we're going to look at the history of impeachment in the United States, going back to Andrew Johnson through Richard Nixon, which, of course, was not a formal impeachment, but with that looming, the president resigned, and then the impeachment of Bill Clinton. No American president has been removed from office by the U.S. Senate. We'll have that to come, as well as moving away from politics on a lighter note, looking at the history of the automobile in L.A.
First of all, I hope that we can now move forward with this process in a way that is fair, that is constitutional, and that is timely. The American people have been through a lot on this, and I think that everyone deserves that. Beyond that, I have nothing to say. It is not in my hands. It is in the hands of Congress and the people of this country. Ultimately, in the hands of God. There's nothing I can do.
That's President Bill Clinton addressing reporters right after the House voted to open an impeachment inquiry in 1998. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're going to take a look back at previous impeachments, how they compare and contrast with the impeachment inquiry that's opened into President Trump. Also talk additionally about how the transcript of his conversation with the Ukrainian president compares to some of the other allegations made against previous presidents. And speaking of the Ukrainian president and President Trump, they are meeting today, and there will be a news conference at 1 o'clock Pacific time, which we will air live right here on 89.3. NPR will be providing the live coverage. It'll be hosted by Jeremy Hobson and a number of other important NPR correspondents, including our guest this hour, Ron Elving. But we begin looking back at the Clinton impeachment with Michael Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent with Yahoo News, who extensively covered the Clinton impeachment. And he's the author of the book, hard to believe it's 20 years ago now, Uncovering Clinton. Michael, good to have you with us again on Air Talk. We appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
How did it get to be 20 years? Oh, my goodness.
I remember talking about the book on your show.
Yes, you did.
It was quite a while ago.
We've been at this a long time. You compare this to what's going on with Trump. Are there really any similarities here?
Well, look, every case is different. Every impeachment that we've gone through has been very different. I think the most useful thing to remember from the Clinton experience is just because a president gets impeached does not mean he gets removed from office. And in fact, the only two presidents who have been impeached, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, were both acquitted in the Senate. So that's one useful yardstick. Now, Clinton was impeached for perjury, for lying about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky in his sworn deposition in the Paula Jones sexual harassment case, and for obstruction of justice. A number of Democrats in the House have cited that as a case of low crimes and misdemeanors, as opposed to the constitutional language of high crimes and misdemeanors as the basis for impeachment. The allegations involving Trump, some of which have been pretty well substantiated by this new transcript we just got today, raise larger questions about abuse of power and abuse of office that would seem to fit more comfortably into the constitutional language about high crimes and misdemeanors. But I think it's also worth pointing out that in the two previous cases of presidents impeached and throw in Nixon, who was facing impeachment and then resigned to head it off. In each and every instance, the people pushing for impeachment in the House focused on actual statutory definitions of federal crimes, that federal crimes were committed. You can make the case that the evidence in the Mueller report amounted to obstruction of justice, although Robert Mueller ultimately did not say that. He said he couldn't reach that conclusion because of Justice Department policy. This transcript showing the pressure that that Trump was putting on Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, for to open up an investigation into Joe Biden's son, seems an abuse. I think most people will view it as that, but does it translate into a actual violation of a federal criminal statute? It's not clear it does. The complainant, we've learned today, who went to the inspector general, was talking about a potential campaign finance violation. That is going to seem to a lot of people as a stretch. So, you know, there's a lot here that people are going to be parsing through.
Well, yeah. And Michael, looking back at the Clinton impeachment, there it was, you know, much more black and white. He actually lied. But that still didn't sway so much of the country. You looked at and said, you know, sort of, I don't mean to be flip about this, but essentially, well, yeah, he lied about an affair and people knew that, you know, Bill Clinton, you know, saw other women outside of his marriage and just sort of, you know, except for the Republicans who were really behind that impeachment, there was not, you know, a public push for this.
That's true. And I think one of the reasons that, you know, Speaker Pelosi has been so hesitant to do what she finally did yesterday and say we are conducting an impeachment inquiry is precisely for that reason, that one takeaway from the Clinton experience is that that a president should not be impeached as a partisan exercise and shouldn't be impeached when there is not overwhelming public support for it, because you are overturning the results of an election. And until now, you know, for all the venting about the Mueller report and the damning details in it, it's pretty clear that it didn't persuade any Republicans that it was the grounds for Trump's impeachment, and it didn't persuade the public either. Public opinion polls showed, you know, south of 50%, well south of 50% in some polls, supporting impeachment. So, does the new information about the Ukraine and the president's phone call, does that change the needle? We don't know. Clearly, some Republicans are uncomfortable about this. Witness the remarks of Mitt Romney. But it's not yet clear whether many will come over into the, you know, whether any will support impeachment, certainly in the House. And what it does in public opinion, we're just going to have to wait and see.
We're talking with Michael Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent with Yahoo News. He covered the Clinton impeachment process and wrote the book Uncovering Clinton. Also with us, the aforementioned NPR senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving. And speaking of the lack of public popularity of impeachment, Ron, you just were reporting on that very fact. Americans don't particularly like impeachment as a rule.
That has been the record, both in the Richard Nixon case, when approval for impeachment and removal of Richard Nixon did not break above 50% until 10 days before he resigned. And that after the Supreme Court had ruled 9-0 that he had to turn over his tapes and the presidency was unraveling in everyone's plain view. Only then did it go over 50%. Way back at the beginning of the Senate investigation in the summer of 1973, it was 19%. At the end of that summer, when you'd have thought, after 14 weeks of televised hearings that most everyone saw at least some of, that there would have been a groundswell for it, but there wasn't. It was still only about 25%. And as Michael's already said, I mean, back in the Clinton days, there was not that much support for it. Even in the month that Clinton was impeached, the Gallup poll showed only 30% of the country was in favor of that impeachment. Now, we're already higher than that with respect to the Trump prospect of impeachment. That's been running in the 30s, over 40% in some polls for some time. So we will have to wait and see what this week's developments mean.
Ron, what's your thoughts about how close this is coming to the election itself? Because this could be a rather lengthy process, even going into the primary season of early next year. And does that at all change, you think, the American perspective of this, since obviously voters are going to have a chance to make their decision?
People in Washington think that the election has already begun. People in Iowa and New Hampshire feel already inundated with the 2020 election. But for much of the country, it's still 2019. And they still think they have 13, 14 months before they have to decide on their 2020 presidential vote. So we've got a little bit of time, and it is possible that if the House moves fairly quickly and extends their session beyond its normal course this fall, they could get to some sort of a point, say before the end of the calendar year, with some extraordinary scheduling, as they did in 1998, to work in an actual vote on the House floor of impeachment, and then we would see how the Senate would respond.
On previous impeachments, Ron, did they look at specifics, violations of the law, and attempt to use that as the reason for drafting the articles of impeachment, as opposed to, for lack of a better term, ethical violations?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that even in the Clinton case, where you clearly had something that had overtones of sexual impropriety really driving the conversation, they looked for what they could point to as actual crime: perjury, lying to a grand jury, and certainly that had happened. And then also obstruction of justice, a somewhat more difficult point to prove. And they really did try to get Clinton on the law and not just on the ethics. When you go back to the Richard Nixon case, there were a number of occasions that the tapes finally made crystal clear the president had encouraged his aides, ordered his aides, in essence, to obstruct justice. So that was not particularly difficult. And it also tied the president to a conspiracy that included a number of actual crimes.
We're talking with NPR's Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent. Ron, can you give us a little bit of background on the Andrew Johnson impeachment?
Well, I like to tell folks that I actually did not cover that.
You didn't cover that, but yeah, I was there.
I have strong personal memories of the Nixon and certainly Clinton impeachments.
I was an
Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson got in trouble with the House and the Senate back in his day because, number one, he was an unelected president. He'd been vice president under Abraham Lincoln after the assassination. He became president. He was kind of a ticket-balancing kind of guy. He had a background as a Democrat, not a Republican, and he was from Tennessee. So he actually had some ties to the South. And he was being relatively generous to the South in the immediate years after the Civil War in the eyes of the hardcore Republican majority in the House and Senate. And they were distressed that the South was not being, you know, sufficiently held to account or forced to empower and enfranchise its former slaves, the black citizens of the South. And so there was a great deal of conflict that was essentially aftermath of the Civil War. And Andrew Johnson wound up on the wrong side of that by attempting to fire his Secretary of War, who was a holdover from the Lincoln years, kind of a controversial figure in his own right. But this all became a kind of surrogate controversy over how he was handling the South. And he was impeached in the House and acquitted in the Senate by a single vote.
Wow.
A single vote.
And was there an effort to try and hold him to account for specific violations of the law?
Yes, with respect to whether or not he had properly processed the firing of the Secretary of War. And that was a bit of a fine point. Generally speaking, we have conceded to the president the right to have his own cabinet members, even if he inherited them from a previous president. Everything was inherited by Andrew Johnson, including the incredible deep-seated conflict between the regions of the country in that era. And he was doing the best he could, in some people's eyes at least, to bridge that gap, to recognize the country was going to be one again, to act as though the Union had been preserved to be something like it had been before the Civil War. And he was at odds with people who wanted a much more punitive approach and a much more proactive approach in terms of empowering and enfranchising the former enslaved, the new black citizens of the South.
All right. We're talking with Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk. President Trump and the Ukrainian president are meeting today amid all the talk of impeachment and the release of the transcript involving the phone call with the Ukrainian president. Right now, the president, both of Ukraine and President Trump, are speaking. Let's go to that live.
But the country of our country is doing phenomenally well. We are we have the best economy we've ever had. We have the best employment numbers that we've ever had. We have now almost 160 million people working, which is more than we've ever had. So we're doing very well in every respect. And I have a feeling that your country is going to do fantastically well. And whatever we can do,
Thank you very much, Mr. President. It's a great pleasure to me to be here. And it's better to be on TV than by phone.
Yeah.
I think. And Mr. President, thank you very much. And I'm not the first time truly say in New York.
Right.
But I know that you've never been in Ukraine.
That's right.
And your predecessor also, how to say it in English, didn't find time. I mean, so can you give me a word that you will come to our great country?
Well, I'm going to try. And I know a lot of people, I will say this, I know a lot of people from Ukraine. They're great people. And I owned something called the Miss Universe pageants years ago and sold it to IMG. And when I ran for president, I thought maybe it wouldn't be the greatest thing to own the Miss Universe and Miss USA pageants, but it's a great thing. And we had a winner from Ukraine, and we got to know the country very well in a lot of different ways. But it's a country, I think, with tremendous potential.
Yes, I know it, because I'm from that country.
Right.
And I want to thank you for the invitation to Washington.
Right.
You invited me. But I think, I'm sorry, but I think you forgot to tell me the date. But I think in the nearest future.
They'll tell you the date.
Oh, yes, they know.
So there you hear the repartee between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and President Trump. This in advance of their private meeting in New York. And then at 1 o'clock this afternoon, NPR provides live coverage of the president's news conference. And Ron Elving of NPR, who joins us now, will be part of that special coverage. You'll hear live right here on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on the history of impeachment. We're talking with Ron Elving, Michael Isikoff of Yahoo News, and we'll talk with Professor Barbara Perry of the University of Virginia's Miller Center. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in a minute. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. We're talking about impeachment, the inquiry into impeachment, starting in the House of Representatives, as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced yesterday. And we're talking about the history of impeachment with us, Barbara Perry, who's professor and co-chair of the Presidential Oral History Program and the director of the Presidential Studies Program at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Professor Perry, thank you for being with us.
Happy to be with you today.
Do you see any ways that we can effectively compare the inquiry into impeachment of President Trump with the two previous impeachments?
I certainly do. You said two impeachments, but because, of course, Nixon wasn't technically impeached before the House could vote on it, he had resigned. I actually see more comparisons with that case because it involves, if we understand what's happened with this current president, it seems to involve more an issue of misuse of power, abuse of power, abusing the power of the office of the presidency, possibly sliding into obstruction of justice, contempt of the Congress, that sort of thing. So I actually think it has more in common with the Nixon situation than it does with the Bill Clinton actual impeachment or the Andrew Johnson impeachment.
Let's go back and look at how rarely this has been used, despite tremendous political discord in the country. I mean, we look at the partisan divisiveness now, of course. This isn't the only period in American history we've, of course, experienced this. So why the rarity of impeachment?
Well, I think, first of all, because the bar is so high, and thank goodness, we don't want the people's vote, such as it was, you know, prior to universal suffrage that we now have, that everyone virtually 18 and over can vote. But still, we viewed ourselves as at least a republic, if not a direct democracy. So we don't want willy-nilly or every few presidents to have the people's will overturned by an impeachment and a conviction and a removal from office. So one, the founders set the bar high, granted without sometimes enough definition of something like high crimes and misdemeanors, but nevertheless, I think set the bar high. The other is that I think what you can say is the three impeachments or near impeachments that we've had come at times of great divisiveness in our country, but not every period of divisiveness in our country has led to impeachment. And that's a good thing.
And take us back to the creation of the impeachment process. What was the stated intent of that?
Right. Well, of course, the founders gathered in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 some thought they were coming simply to revise the first constitution that we lived under, the so-called Articles of Confederation, but that was failing because there wasn't a strong enough central power in a national government, and there really wasn't an executive branch or a judicial branch. There was a Congress only. So with this delicate balance that they created, I'm sitting about 30 miles from James Madison's home here in Virginia and just down the street from Monticello. Thomas Jefferson was not there in Philadelphia, but certainly James Madison was, and presented this constitution. And their thought, I think, was just what I've suggested, that in this delicate balance of three branches of government, which they thought were very necessary, going back to the English system of a parliament, an executive in the form of a monarch, and a relatively speaking, strong judiciary, that they thought that was important to have those three branches of government, but that they would then check and balance each other. And one of those checks would be that if a president, if a chief executive, got too far out over the skis, legally speaking, and engaged in bribery, treason, high crimes, or misdemeanors, then there was a way for the Congress, with both houses at work, not just one house of Congress, but truly in a bicameral way, to check that president and do that in between elections.
And the severity of that would kick the process into motion. That's left totally to the discretion of the office holders at the time.
Yes, indeed, because they, and again, remember all of the different checks and balances, what they used to say, and Madison wrote in the Federalist Papers, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. My other favorite line was, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. So recognizing that men weren't angels, you need a government, but you also need to check that government, and it needs internal checks as well. And then the balance, even in Congress, where you have the House members elected every 2 years and the senators elected every 6 years, even that was meant to be a difference. And remember that at the time, only the House members were elected directly by the people, such as that franchise was just white males who had property, but nevertheless directly elected by the people. Remember, until the early 20th century, senators were elected by state legislatures. So all of these different approaches, different terms of office, no term limits at the time, but different approaches to the office coming from different constituencies, that was all meant to make sure the government had enough power to act, but not ever to become a tyranny over the people.
Professor Perry, is there anything in the documents regarding the crafting of the impeachment process that indicated caution about it being used for political purposes, or is it silent on that?
I don't know of anything specifically in there, but I wouldn't doubt that, for example, Madison kept notes on the debates at Philadelphia. They are not necessarily word for word in real time, as it were, but still kept pretty careful notes. And they were so careful to try to check that political impulse. They knew, of course, that politics would and be involved in government, but also remember this: they do not speak in the Constitution of political parties. They speak later on in the articles in the Federalist Papers about the issue of factions. And when they walked out of Philadelphia, they developed into two parties based on whether they supported the Constitution or they did not support its ratification. So they, of course, understood politics. They were very well schooled in ancient political philosophy and more modern political philosophy, but I don't think they thought in terms of the kind of partisanship we see today. So even better that they didn't necessarily understand where we would be with universal suffrage, political parties, mass media, and now social media, but yet the system is still working.
Professor Perry, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
She's professor at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, where she directs the Presidential Studies Program, and she's co-chair of the university's Presidential Oral History Program. Let me go back to Michael Isikoff, Yahoo News, chief investigative correspondent who covered the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Michael, what are you most closely going to be watching as this process gets underway with President Trump?
Well, there's so much that we still don't know. The identity of the whistleblower, will he be allowed to testify in public? Will we hear his or her story, since we don't really know the whistleblower's gender or anything else about who it is. And I think that can matter a lot. You know, the question that the Democrats have to wrestle with right now is, do they commence what could be a lengthy investigation with public hearings in which they call various witnesses, such as Rudy Giuliani, such as the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, who's referred to in quite derogatory terms by the president in the transcript we just got. You know, or do they strike while the iron is hot, while the fire is hot, and go directly to impeachment? I mean, you know, they've got some wind on their sails right now with the release of the transcript that clearly shows the president making this request of the president of Ukraine to commence investigations of Biden's son. There it is. Is that enough? I don't know. I think they wanted to hear more about the whistleblower, but I got to say, and the Justice Department opinion, OLC opinion that was just released, which says the whistleblower's complaint was all about a potential campaign finance violation. I don't know that that's a winning argument for the Democrats that will push the ball forward much on impeachment. I think if they could keep it just to the president's request, they've got an article of impeachment that will cut through and people can understand. If it's about what the whistleblower was complaining about as this being a potential campaign finance violation because the president was soliciting a thing of value from a foreign government that could help his political campaign, I think that's going to I don't think that's going to sell quite as much.
Yeah, and then the question is, if you don't do it with the rising to the level of essentially a criminal act, is alleged campaign finance violation, is that going to get the kind of public support that I'm sure Democrats are hoping for here? Michael, thank you very much. Good to talk with you. We appreciate it. Thanks. Michael Iskoff, Yahoo News. Ron Elving, again, you'll be hearing him during the 1 o'clock hour. Ron, I know all this is happening so quickly, but do you have any sense as to whether Democrats are looking at this rough transcript saying, there's enough here, let's push for articles of impeachment, or whether they're looking at a long, multiple interview investigative process?
There is the prospect of something a little bit in between, and that would be to press for the full transcript, not the version that has just been released, which has been called something of a summary. See it all. Let's see it all. And why was some of it not allowed out? And then apparently there are other conversations that have taken place between the two presidents, Trump and Zelensky. Can we see those as well? How about summaries of those transcripts? How about the full transcript of those conversations? What else was said at other times? And, of course, they need to find out what exactly the whistleblower was objecting to and find out whether or not the Justice Department is telling the whole story.
All right. And we just in the conversation, and they're still speaking to reporters, President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine. And President Zelensky said, nobody pushed me to probe Biden. He was asked by a reporter, did you feel pushed in that conversation with President Trump? He sidestepped part of that, but said, nobody pushed me. Ron, thanks so much. We'll look forward to hearing your analysis on the president's news conference in our 1 o'clock hour Pacific time. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you, Larry.
Senior editor and correspondent for NPR, Ron Elving. Coming up on a totally different note, we're going to take a break from politics and impeachment inquiry to take a look at Los Angeles's automotive history, manufacturing here, design here, and the whole art of the car sale. We'll talk about that after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us again. Our coverage of all that's going on around the impeachment inquiry into President Trump's actions. Be with you throughout the course of the day, including at 1 o'clock, live NPR coverage of the presidential news conference. But we turn our attention now to the automobile in Los Angeles. Perhaps only Detroit as a city has the kind of association with cars as Los Angeles does. It's a city that has been built around the automobile. Manufacturing was done here. Design of automobiles was done here. And as we're going to learn in the next few minutes, the whole way that car dealerships, showrooms, and the sales process developed largely came out of Los Angeles as well. Joining me is the chief historian at the Peterson Automotive Museum on Museum Row, Leslie Kendall. Leslie, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Great to be here.
I appreciate it. Let's start first of all with just LA as a car-centric city. We're sort of, you know, developed in the right time for the automobile, didn't we?
LA and the automobile were born together, grew up together, and have been linked ever since.
And the manufacturing side of it, where were the different factories and which automakers had them here?
Well, early on, it was a lot of different factories. It was dozens of factories, people making cars one or two or three at a time and burping them out for 8 or 10 years. The 20s and 30s came along, and there was a great deal of consolidation in Detroit and Cleveland and St. Louis. And then it ended up doing a number on the little local manufacturers. But then the major Detroit folk came back with a vengeance and set up satellite plants in the area to take advantage of the labor force and the raw material supply lines that were here.
So is that the raw material supply lines, meaning we had railroad port access, that sort of thing?
Yes, we did. We had a lot of access to those things. What we did not have, and what is essential for supporting any kind of industry, is coal, timber, fresh water, and iron. L.A. did not have any of those things, but what we did have was a lot of people with a lot of talent.
And so let's talk about the factories. So General Motors had a large plant in Van Nuys, employed thousands of people.
They sure did. That closed, in terms of automotive history, not that long ago, and it's still pretty well remembered today. People drive by the freeway and go, yeah, I remember when they used to build GM cars over there.
And we also had the parts supply. Firestone had a huge tire factory here.
Right. It wasn't just the manufacturers. It was the people that supplied the tires, the bumpers, you name it. And there was also a great deal of oil here, too. So we also had a leg up on infrastructure.
Do you know, let's say off the top of your head, how many people at its height would have been employed in Southern California, generally automotive-related industry, design, manufacture, sales, all of it?
Well, depending on how you calculate it, hundreds of thousands would have been reached by that in all industries in general, including design, including maintenance, including manufacturing, all those sorts of things. Automobiles are very important to the economy because they employ so many people. So many people have things to do with either building cars, maintaining them, designing them, caring for the infrastructure that supports them.
How did Los Angeles become a design center for the automobile? What led to that?
Hollywood helped, I have to tell you, because Hollywood and the car grew up at the same time. They both took advantage of what made each other interesting, and that was motion. And Hollywood thought it was a very good idea for its stars to be seen in exotic, interesting automobiles, sexy cars. You know, so if you had Tom Mix riding around in your 1922 Leech, then you were doing pretty good. And that helped propagate the enthusiasm for Los Angeles, and people started thinking, wow, that's a pretty cool place to be. They may not have the ability to make cars, but they sure have the means to enjoy them. We have the mountains, we have the deserts, we have the oceans, we have Sunset Boulevard, we have all those great places to see and be seen.
My grandfather had a cord that supposedly a gangster had been killed in, and it was
what higher compliment?
I was going to say, yeah, how much more L.A. than that can you get?
Oh, there's L.A. is a colorful place, colorful people, and may I say, colorful cars.
Absolutely. I'd love to hear your questions, your comments about Los Angeles and car culture, the manufacturing side, the design of automobiles, the sales of cars. You know, when I was a kid in the 1960s, you'd see car commercials on air all day long and live car commercials in the middle of the night. Guys would be sitting in car lots, sometimes with a dog alongside them, Ron Shuchem, people like that, doing car commercials, inviting people to come on down who'd undoubtedly work swing shift at a factory to come down buy a car at 11 at night. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. And speaking of the retail side of it, I'm joined by Daryl Holter, who's a car historian and CEO of the Shamus Group, which has owned the Felix Chevrolet dealership downtown Los Angeles since 1957. Up until a couple years ago, they owned the downtown LA Auto Group with those dealerships along the Figueroa Corridor, as well as the dealership in Carson. Daryl, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about the influence of car dealers as well, because, you know, my sense of local LA television in those early years, the 50s and 60s, you know, car dealers were propping a lot of that programming up.
Well, they did. I mean, of course, television was and radio before that was extremely important for advertising. But what I found in the research that I'm doing is that while the manufacturers were able to developed some very reliable cars by 1920, the first two decades were essentially a period when they were trying to figure out how to do that. And the dealers were coming in and trying to figure out how they would actually merchandise and sell cars. And the factories weren't that involved in those aspects of it. So it was dealers sort of working on a trial and error basis, figuring out how to do this. Of course, this is a startup industry. This had never been done before. And so the dealers played really an important role in linking the customer to the manufacturer. And they did this in a lot of ways. In one way, they provided the capital for the car makers to buy the parts that they needed to assemble their cars.
They fronted that money.
By getting deposits from customers. And so the dealers would give the deposits to the manufacturers, and the manufacturers, the early manufacturers, would use that capital to pay for the parts that they used to assemble the cars. And at the same time, the dealers were the ones that were building a sort of facilities and showrooms to accommodate car buyers that they were paying for themselves. And initially, cars were purchased all by cash, only by cash. Banks refused to lend to car buyers. It was viewed as a craze, a fad. And so LA dealers would start experimenting with deferred payments and promissory notes that allowed less affluent customers to buy cars.
Daryl, one of the things that strikes me when I see some of the old dealerships, and we have some here in Pasadena that have been adapted for reuse, is they were not very big at all. And I'm wondering, did you just have like one example of each model and people would put in an order to get the car, but they wouldn't necessarily test drive the actual vehicle they're purchasing?
Okay. Initially, the first auto row was on Main Street. And essentially, the dealers there would just widen an opening of a door so they could get a car in. They would put one car in there. It was called a demonstrator. And that demonstrator would be used to show people what this car would look like. And then they could drive it around the block if they knew how to drive it. And then if they wanted to buy it, they could put a deposit on it. And the dealer would send the deposit to the manufacturer. The manufacturer would make the car. And eventually it would be shipped to Los Angeles and the customer would come and get it.
So you wouldn't have a chance. Like now you go on a lot, you actually drive the car, you're interested in buying. You couldn't do that. You'd agree to buy it before you even drove it.
You know, everything became more complicated as the industry grew. Initially, as I said, cars were sold for cash. And initially, dealers didn't provide any service. There were no warranties. They didn't exist. And so the first dealers would say, well, if the customer needs service, you know, go down the street. There's a guy that hung an auto repair a sign on his place and maybe check that out. Eventually, the dealers start coming up with their own sort of little warranty plans until finally, as we get closer into the closer to the 1920, the manufacturers start offering it.
All right, we'll take a break, come back. Our conversation with historian Daryl Holter. He's the CEO of the Shamus Group, which has owned Felix Chevrolet downtown since 1957. Also with us, Leslie Kendall, chief historian at the Peterson Automotive Museum. Jim in Studio City asks, why have all the colorful car designs gone away? We'll get an answer to that question coming up in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Cars are such a huge part of Greater Los Angeles's culture. We talked a few weeks ago about racing and how that was centered here. Right now, we're talking about the manufacturing, the design, and the selling of cars and its significance to Los Angeles. You have questions for our guests. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Our guests are chief historian of the Peterson Automotive Museum on Museum Row in Los Angeles, Leslie Kendall, and historian and car dealer operator himself, Daryl Holter. Jim in Studio City asks, why have colorful car designs gone away? I feel like today's cars are monochromatic, and we used to have jewel-toned cars from my childhood. Jim asks, Leslie?
Well, today driving is a serious business. People don't look at it as a an adventure, as a means to get away. They look at it as they look upon it as a kind of a necessary evil. And when you have a when you're interacting with something that embodies a necessary evil, I don't know that it lends itself to colorful gestures and that kind of extroverted exuberance that you once had in the 50s. Things were pink and yellow and green, and you had these marvelous choices. That's because America was on top of the world. I mean, we were feeling our oats. We were very carefree. We can do anything kind of place. Now it's we're locked into cars. We have to have them. And the public wants cars that can go fast on freeways. They want cars that get good mileage. They want cars that embody all these characteristics. And when you come right down to it, cars converge on a certain cars for a given purpose and size all converge on the same shape, and they eventually converge on the same color. Now it's getting a little bit more interesting. We're seeing more browns out there, mm-hmm. which I think is absolutely fascinating. I've seen more orange cars in the past year than I have my entire life.
Yeah, that does seem to be happening. I would argue that we're a kind of a staid period in design generally, that just even how people dress, it's not a particularly colorful time, and we just seem to be going through one of those periods where we're kind of somber in our design.
Well, I think we're being a little bit more serious than we have a lot of times before. I think we first got a taste of that seriousness during the Depression, and then, of course, during the gas crisis of 73. About that time, convertibles went away, and we forget about that extroverted, open-air, you know, come one, come all motoring feeling. And vans became interesting. We kind of withdrew into vans.
These little isolation
chambers on wheels.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Daryl, I want to go back to you and ask you about the early plants here where the cars were made. Were they largely assembling facilities more than anything else?
Well, initially they were largely assembling cars. They would go out and get a wagon. They would go out and get four bicycle wheels. They would go out and get some engine, a steam, electric, gasoline, and they would maybe put a tiller on it so that they could steer. I mean, that's the simplest formula. I'm breaking it down, but they were assembled. So there were probably 15 to 20 of these small car makers in L.A. Hand assembling a lot of these cars. But then there was a very interesting one called the Tourist, which was functioning in L.A. manufacturing, sold something I've seen between 3,000 and 5,000 vehicles between 1902 and 1910. And that was the Tourist here in Los Angeles. There is a Tourist that's on display at the Natural History Museum. You can go and look at it. The company closed in 1910, citing financial problems caused by selling cars on credit and the increase of rent on Main Street. As the automobile dealerships became more complex and needed more space, they started to evolve. They moved to the west over on Olive Street, so that in 1910, there were 105 brands of cars being sold by 70 dealers on the Olive Street area. Eventually, in the next decade, as they needed more space, they moved over to Figaro and Flower Street. So by 1927, there were 52 new and used car operations on Figueroa. Is that the
52 on Figueroa?
Yes, 52 brands of new and used. And that became then the Auto Row, and people kind of forgot about the other ones. If you go to a restaurant in downtown, if you go to the Palm Restaurant, you'll have a good example of a 1926 automobile dealership that was built as an automobile dealership.
And of course, the 20s, boom years for Los Angeles. Construction you look at any of those silent films from the 20s, everything's a construction site. They're just, the whole city seems like it's being erected in the 1920s. And there's a lot of money, and I assume, Leslie, a lot of cars sold.
There are a lot of cars, a lot of money. You're right, a lot of people are becoming very successful here. And the rail lines that led you to population centers were becoming less and less important because people spread out. Cars allowed people to spread out, so spread out they did. And, nobody left at exactly the same time from the same place to go to the same work spot every morning. So we ended up being very reliant on cars, and all those dealerships helped.
Is there a particular car designed here that we think of as iconic that was designed in Los Angeles? We can say that for sure.
What I can tell you is that so many, virtually every manufacturer with an international presence has a design studio in one of three Southern California counties, San Diego, Orange, Los Angeles. And also right in the backyard of where we are now in Pasadena, the Art Center College of Design.
A few doors down.
They graduate more car designers than anywhere else. But so many things came out of here. It's very hard to find a dealership or walk by a lot that does not have some direct relationship to Southern California, to people who design cars here. This is a sexy place to be. You know, this is the place when you design cars, you want to be in the thick of it. And that's the whole idea.
So let me put in the plug for the Peterson Museum, where you're the chief historian, because there are remarkable examples of this history of Los Angeles so that we better understand it. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, Daryl, about the Felix cartoon character on your neon sign. How did that come to be? How did you get the rights to Felix?
What happened was that Pat Sullivan, who was the designer of Felix the Cat, was a friend of Winslow B. Felix, who was the owner and the first owner of Felix Chevrolet. They became friends, and they began to cross-market the Felix Chevrolet with Felix the Cat. And so the cat was used for advertising beginning in 1921, with the beginning of our store in 1921. And that relationship has continued to today. I mean, we have a lot of Felix the Cat, Felix Chevrolet products.
I remember when the cartoons would show on television, you know, after school, there'd be Felix Chevrolet ads hand in hand.
The Felix Chevy website has a lot of the history, so people can check that out and you'll get
a lot of
this history.
Daryl Holter, Leslie Kendall, thank you both very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Thanks, Larry.
Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up next. And, of course, 1 o'clock, the live news conference, President Trump, NPR's coverage here on 89.3.